blurring of land and sea and sky. Jagged white mountains, angry white-tipped waves on an ash-gray sea. Cabins and homes clinging stubbornly to a wild shoreline. Homer slowly disappeared from view. Seattle at night in the falling rain. A snake of yellow headlights in the dark. Neon signs everywhere, reflections cast on wet streets, traffic lights changing color, horns honking out staccato warnings. Music tumbled out of open doors, assaulting the night, unlike any music Lenny had heard before. It had a clanging, angry sound, and some of the people standing outside of the bars looked like they'd landed from Mars, with safety pins in their cheeks and stiff blue mohawks and black clothes that appeared to have been cut to ribbons. "It's okay," Mama said, pulling Lenny in close as they walked past a group of homeless-looking people who stood listlessly in a park, passing cigarettes back and forth. Lenny saw the city in bits and pieces through lowered lashes, blurred by the incessant rain. She saw women with babies huddled in doorways and men asleep in sleeping bags beneath the elevated road that looked down on this section of town. Lenny couldn't imagine why people would live this way when they could go to Alaska and live off the land and build themselves a home. She couldn't help thinking about all those girls who'd been abducted in 1974 and found dead not far from here. Ted Bundy had been arrested, but did that mean the streets were safe now? Mama found a payphone and called a taxi. As they stood there waiting for it to arrive, the rain stopped. A bright yellow cab pulled up to the dirty curb, splashing water on them. Lenny followed her mama into the back seat, which smelled aggressively of pine. From here on, Lenny saw the lights of the city through a window. With water everywhere, in drips and puddles, but no rain falling, the place had a jumbled, multicolored carnival look. They angled uphill. The old brick and low-rise part of the city, Pioneer Square, was apparently the pit people climbed out of when they got money. Downtown was a canyon of office buildings, skyscrapers, and stores set on busy streets with windows that looked like movie sets, inhabited by mannequins dressed in glitzy suits with exaggerated shoulder pads and cinched-in waists. At the top of the hill, the city gave way to a neighborhood of stately homes. "There it is," Mama said to the cabbie, giving him the last of their borrowed cash. The house was bigger than Lenny remembered. In the dark, it looked vaguely sinister, with its peaked roof pointing high into a black night sky and glowing diamond-paned windows. All of it was surrounded by an iron fence topped with heart-piercing spires. "You sure?" Lenny asked quietly. Lenny knew what this had cost her mother, coming home for help. She saw the impact of it in her mother's eyes, in the slump of her shoulders, in the way her hands curled into fists. Mama felt like a failure coming back here. "It just proves they were right about him all along. We could disappear from here too, start over by ourselves. I might do that for myself, baby girl, but not for you. I was a crappy mother. I am going to be a good grandmother. Please, don't give me a way out." She took a deep breath. "Let's go." Lenny took hold of Mama's hand. They walked up the stone path together, where spotlights shone on bushes sculpted to look like animals and spiky rose bushes cut back for winter. At the ornate front door, they paused, waited. Then Mama knocked. Moments later, the door opened and Grandma appeared. The years had changed her. Imprinted and pulled at her face, her hair had gone gray, or maybe it had always been gray and she'd stopped dyeing it. "Oh my God," she whispered, clamping a thin hand to her mouth. "Hey, Mom," Mama said, her voice unsteady. Lenny heard footsteps. Grandma stepped aside. Grandpa moved in beside her. He was a big man, fat stomach straining at a blue cashmere sweater, big floppy jowls, white hair that was combed across his shiny head, the strands carefully tended. Baggy black polyester pants, cinched tight with a belt, suggested bird-thin legs underneath. He looked older than his 70 years. "Hey," Mama said. Her grandparents stared at them, eyes narrowed, seeing the bruises on Lenny's and Mama's faces, the swollen cheeks, the black eyes.
Son of a bitch,
Grandpa said. We need help, Mama said, squeezing Lenny's hand.
Where is he?
Grandpa wanted to know. We've left him, Mama said. Thank God, Grandma said.
Do we need to worry about him coming to look for you, breaking down my door?
Grandpa asked. Mama shook her head. No, never. Grandpa's eyes narrowed. Did he understand what that meant? What they'd done?
What do you...
I'm pregnant, Lenny said. They had talked about this, she and Mama, and decided to say nothing about the pregnancy yet. But now that they were here, asking for help, begging, Lenny couldn't do it. She had kept enough secrets in her life. She didn't want to live in the shadows of them anymore.
Apple doesn't fall far from the tree, Mama said, trying to smile.
We've been here before,
Grandpa said.
I seem to recall my advice to you.
You wanted me to give her up and come home and pretend I could be the girl I was before, Mama said. And I wanted you to say it was okay, that you loved me anyway.
What we said, Grandma said softly, was that there were women in our church who were unable to have children and would have given your baby a good home.
I'm keeping my baby, Lenny said. If you don't want to help us, it's fine, but I'm keeping the baby.
Mama squeezed her hand. Silence followed Lenny's declaration. In it, Lenny glimpsed the largeness of the world for her and Mama now, the ocean of troubles they faced on their own, and it frightened her, but not as much as the idea of the world she would inhabit if she gave up this baby. Some choices you don't recover from. She was old enough to know that. Finally, after what felt like forever, Grandma turned to her husband.
Cecil, how many times have we talked about a second chance? This is it.
You won't run off in the middle of the night again?
He said to Mama.
Your mother barely survived it.
In those few words, carefully chosen, Lenny heard sorrow. There was hurt between these people and her mother. Hurt and regret and mistrust, but something softer, too.
No, sir, we won't.
At last, Grandpa smiled.
Welcome home, Coraline. Lenora, let's get some ice on those bruises. You both should see a doctor.
Lenny saw Mama's reluctance to step into the house. She took Mama by the arm, steadied her.
Don't let go,
Mama whispered. Inside, Lenny noticed the smell of flowers. There were several large floral arrangements positioned artfully on gleaming wooden tables and gilt-edged mirrors on the walls. Lenny glanced into rooms and down hallways as they walked. She saw a dining room with a table that accommodated 12, a library with floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, a living room in which there were two of everything, sofas, chairs, windows, lamps. A staircase with carpet so plush it felt like walking on muskeg in the summer led to an upstairs hallway that was paneled in mahogany and decorated with brass sconces and paintings of dogs and horses in ornate golden frames. Here, Grandma said, finally stopping. Grandpa hung back, as if maybe doling out rooms were women's work.
Lenora, you will sleep in Coraline's old room. Cora, come this way.
Lenny stepped into her new room. At first, all she saw was lace. Not the cheap eyelet she was used to seeing at Goodwill. This was fine, almost like cobwebs strung together. Ivory lace curtains framed the windows. There was more ivory lace on the bedding and lampshades. On the floor, pale oatmeal-colored carpeting. Furniture was ivory with gilt edges. A small, kidney-shaped desk had an ivory-colored cushioned stool tucked up underneath. The air felt stifling, unnatural, bathed in a false lavender scent. She went to the window, lifted the heavy sash, and leaned out. The sweet night welcomed her, calmed her. The rain had stopped, leaving a glittering black night in its wake. Lights were on in all the houses up and down the street. There was a small patch of wet roof in front of her.
Below that, the well-tended yard, with an old maple tree tucked in close, its branches mostly bare, only a few red-gold leaves still hanging on. Trees, night air, quiet. Lenny climbed out onto the shake-covered roof below her room. Although there were lights on in the house, and houses with lights on across the street, she felt safer out here. She smelled trees and greenery, and even a distant tang of the sea. The sky was unfamiliar, black. In Alaska, the night sky in winter was a deep velvet blue, and when snow covered the ground and cloaked the trees, ambient light created a magical glow. And then sometimes the northern lights danced overhead. Still, she recognized the stars. They weren't in the same place, but they were the same stars. The Big Dipper, Orion's Belt. Constellations Matthew had shown her that night when they'd lain on the beach. Her fingers closed around the heart necklace at her throat. She could wear it openly now and not worry about her father asking where she'd gotten it. She would never take it off again.
You want some company?
Sure, Lenny said, scooting sideways. Mama climbed through the open window and made her way onto the roof, then sat beside Lenny, drawing her knees up to her chest.
I used to climb down that tree and sneak out on Saturday nights in high school to hang out with boys at Dick's Drive-In on Aurora. Everything was about boys.
She sighed, dropped her chin into the valley between her knees. Lenny leaned against her mama, stared out at the house across the street, a blaze of wasteful lights. Through the windows, she saw at least three televisions flashing color.
I'm sorry, Lenny. I've made such a mess of your life.
We did it, Lenny said. Together. Now we have to live with it.
There's something wrong with me,
Mama said after a pause. No, Lenny said firmly. There was something wrong with him.
It's there, believe me. Right there. Mama said 5 days later, when their bruises had healed enough to be covered with makeup.
They had spent almost a week huddled in the house, never venturing outside. They were both going a little stir-crazy. Now, with Mama's hair cut in a pixie and dyed brown, they finally left the house and took a bus into busy downtown Seattle, where they merged into the eclectic crowd of tourists, shoppers, and punk rockers. Mama pointed up into the cloudless blue sky. Lenny didn't care about the mountain. That was what they called Rainier down here, the mountain, as if it were the only one that mattered in the world. Or the other landmarks Mama had pointed out with such pride, as if Lenny had never seen them before. The bright neon public market sign that looked down on the fish market booth. The Space Needle, which looked like an alien spacecraft placed on pickup sticks. The new aquarium that jutted defiantly out into the cold waters of Elliott Bay. Seattle was beautiful on this sunny, warm November day, that was true, as green as she remembered, and bordered by water, and covered in asphalt and concrete. People crawled like ants over all of it, all noise and movement, honking horns, people crossing streets, buses puffing smoke and grinding gears on the hills that propped the city up. How could she ever be at home here, among all these people? There was no silence in this place. For the last few nights, she'd lain in her new bed, which smelled of fabric softener and store-bought laundry soap, trying to get comfortable. Once an ambulance or police siren had blared all of a sudden, red lights snapping on and off through the window, painting the lace blood red. Now she and Mama were north of the city. They had taken a crosstown bus, found seats among the sad-looking travelers out this early, and walked through the busy Ave and uphill to the sprawling University of Washington. They stood at the edge of something called Red Square. For as far as Lenny could see, the ground had been layered in new red brick. A giant red obelisk pointed up at the blue sky. More new brick buildings created a perimeter. There were literally hundreds of students moving through the square. They came and went in laughing, chattering waves. Off to her left, a group dressed all in black was holding up protest signs about nuclear power and weapons. Several demanded a shutdown of something called Hanford. She was reminded of the college kids she'd seen in Homer every summer, clots of young adults in REI rain gear looking up at the jagged, snow-capped peaks as though they heard God calling their names. She would hear whispered conversations about how they were going to chuck it all and move off the grid and live more authentic lives. Back to the land, they'd said, as if it were biblical verse. Like the famous John Muir quote, "The mountains are calling and I must go." People heard those kinds of voices in Alaska, dreamed new dreams. Most would never go, and of the few who did, the vast majority would leave before the end of their first winter. But Lenny had always known they would be changed simply by the magnitude of the dream and the possibility they glimpsed in the distance. Lenny drifted through the crowd alongside her mother, clutching the small backpack she'd had since she was 12 years old, her Alaska backpack. It felt totemic, the last durable remnant of a discarded life. She wished she'd been able to bring her Winnie the Pooh lunchbox. They arrived at their destination, a sugary pink Gothic building with sweeping arches and delicate spires and intricately scrolled windows. Inside was a library unlike Lenny had ever seen, row upon row of wooden desks decorated with green banker's lamps were positioned beneath an arched ceiling. Gothic chandeliers hung above the desks. And the books. She'd never seen so many. They whispered to her of unexplored worlds and unmet friends, and she realized that she wasn't alone in this new world. Her friends were here, spying out, waiting for her as they always had. If only Matthew could see this. She walked in step with her mother, their clunky boot heels clattering on the floor. Lenny kept expecting people to look up, to point them out as intruders, but the students in the graduate reading room didn't care about strangers in their midst. Even the librarian didn't seem to make any judgments about them as she listened to their questions and gave them directions to another desk, where another librarian listened to their request. "Here you go," the second librarian said, handing them a collection of bound newspapers. Mama said, "Thank you," and sat down. Lenny doubted the librarian heard the tremble in Mama's voice, but Lenny did. She sat down on the wooden bench next to Mama, scooted close. It didn't take much time to find what they were looking for. Connick family missing, foul play suspected. State authorities released information about a missing Connick family. Neighbor Marge Birdsall called state troopers on November 13th to report her neighbors, Cora Albright and her daughter Lenora, missing. "They were supposed to visit me yesterday. They never showed. I worried right off that Ernt had hurt them," said Birdsall. On November 14th, Thomas Walker reported finding an abandoned truck not far from his homestead. The vehicle, registered to Ernt Albright, was found at mile marker 12 on the Connick Road. Authorities reported finding blood on the seat and steering wheel, as well as Cora Albright's purse. "We are investigating this as both a missing persons and as a potential homicide," said Officer Kurt Ward of Homer. Neighbors reported that Ernt Albright had a history of violence, and they feared he killed his wife and daughter and ran off. No additional information is available for release at this time, as the investigation is ongoing. Anyone with information on any of the Albrights is asked to call Officer Ward. Mama leaned back, sighing quietly. Lenny saw the pain Mama carried and would now always carry, for all of it, for staying when she should have left, for loving him, for killing him. What came of pain like that? Did it slowly dissipate, or did it congeal and turn poisonous? "Dad says they'll declare us dead at some point, but it might take 7 years." 7 years? "We have to go forward, learn how to be happy, or what was it all for?" Happy. The word had no buoyancy for Lenny, no lift. To be honest, she couldn't imagine ever being happy again. Not really. "Yeah," Lenny said, trying to smile. "We'll be happy now." 26. That evening, after dinner, Lenny sat on her twin bed, reading. The Stand by Stephen King. Since arriving in Seattle, she'd read three books by him and discovered a new passion. Goodbye science fiction and fantasy, hello horror. She figured it was a reflection of her inner life. She'd rather have nightmares about Randall Flagg or Carrie or Jack Torrance than about her own past. She was just turning a page when she heard voices, lowered, moving past her room. Lenny glanced at the bedside clock, one of dozens in the house, all ticking in time like the beat of a hidden heart. Almost 9 p.m. Usually her grandparents were in bed by now. Lenny set the book aside, marking her page. She went to the door, cracked it open just enough so she could peer out. Lights were on downstairs. Lenny slipped out of her room. Her bare feet made no sound on the plush wool carpeting. Her hand gliding down the smooth mahogany banister, she hurried down the steps. At the bottom, the black and white marble felt cold beneath her feet. Mama was in the living room with her parents. Lenny carefully edged forward, just enough so she could see. Mama sitting on the burnt orange sofa, with her parents sitting across from her in matching paisley wingback chairs. Between them, the maple coffee table was decorated with a forest of ornate china figurines.
"They think he killed us," Mama said. "I read the local papers today."
"He easily might have," Grandma responded. "I warned you, you recall, not to go to Alaska."
"Not to marry him," Grandpa said.
"Do you think I need I told you so's?" Mama said. She sighed heavily. "I loved him."
Lenny heard the sorrow and regret that eddied between the three of them. She wouldn't have understood that kind of regret even a year ago. She did now.
"I don't know what to do from here," Mama said. "I've screwed up Lenny's life and my own, and now I've dragged you into it."
"Are you kidding?" Grandma said. "Of course you dragged us into it. We're your parents."
Grandpa said,
"This is for you."
Lenny wanted to peer around, but didn't dare. She heard the squeaking of a chair, then heels clicking on hardwood floors. Grandpa always wore dress shoes from breakfast to bedtime, and finally, a crumpling paper sound.
"It's a birth certificate," Mama said after a moment. "For an Evelyn Chesterfield, born April 4th, 1939. Why are you giving this to me?"
Lenny heard the squeaking chair again.
"And here's a falsified marriage license. You married a man named Chad Grant. With these two documents, you'll be able to go to the DMV and get a license and a new social security card. I have a birth certificate for Lenny, too. She'll be your daughter, Susan Grant. You two will rent a house not far from here. We will tell everyone you are a relative, or our housekeeper, something. Anything to keep you safe."
Grandpa said, his voice rough with emotion.
"How did you get these?"
"I'm a lawyer. I know people. I paid a client of mine, a man of flexible morals."
"That's not who you are," Mama said quietly.
There was a pause, then,
"We are all of us changed,"
Grandpa said.
"We've learned the hard way, haven't we? By making mistakes. We should have listened to you when you were 16.
And I should have listened to you."
The doorbell rang. The sound was so unexpected at this time of night that Lenny felt a clutch of fear. She heard the sound of footsteps, then the rustle of wooden blinds.
"Police,"
she heard her grandpa say. Mama hurried out of the living room and saw Lenny.
"Go upstairs,"
Grandpa said, following Mama out of the living room. Mama took Lenny's hand and led her up the stairs.
"This way," Mama said. "Quiet."
They hurried up the stairs and tiptoed down the unlit hallway into the master bedroom, a huge room with mullioned windows and olive green carpet. A four-poster bed was dressed in lace that matched the carpet precisely. Mama led Lenny to a heating vent in the floor. With care, she pulled the vent out and set it aside. Mama knelt down, motioned for Lenny to scoot beside her.
"I used to eavesdrop on the nuns when they came to expel me."
Lenny heard footsteps echo through the metal vent slats. men's voices.
Detectives Archer Madison and Keller Watt, Seattle PD.
Grandpa.
Is there something amiss in the neighborhood, officers, at this late hour?
We're here,
something they couldn't hear.
Behalf of Alaska State Troopers.
Words that blended together.
Your daughter, Cora Albright.
Something.
Last seen her, sorry to say, presumed dead.
Lenny heard her grandma cry out.
Here, ma'am, let us help you sit.
A pause, long, then a scuffling sound, a briefcase being opened, papers withdrawn.
The pickup truck found. Cabin full of blood, broken window, obvious crime scene, but the evidence was destroyed by animals. Tests inconclusive. X-rays that showed a broken arm. Broken nose. Search being conducted, but this time of year, weather. God knows what we'll find when the snow melts. Keep you informed. He killed them,
Grandpa said. These words were loud, angry.
Son of a bitch. Many reports. His violence.
Lenny turned to her mama.
So we got away with it? Well, there's no statute of limitations on murder, and everything we've done and will do at the DMV will be evidence of guilt. He was shot in the back and we disposed of the body and ran. If he is ever found, they'll come looking for us. And now my parents have lied for us. Another crime. So we have to be careful. For how long? Forever, baby girl.
Dear Matthew, I've called the rehab facility every day this week. I pretend I'm your cousin. The answer is always the same. No change. It breaks a little more of my heart every time. I know I can never send this letter, and that even if I did, you couldn't read it or wouldn't understand the words. But I have to write to you, even if the words are lost. I told myself, and have been told repeatedly by others, that I need to move on with my new life. And I'm trying to do that. I am. But you are inside of me, a part of me, maybe even the best part. I'm not talking only about our baby. I hear your voice in my head. You talk to me in my sleep so much I've gotten used to waking with tears on my cheeks. I guess my mama was right about love. As screwed up as she is, she understands the durability and lunacy of it. You can't make yourself fall in love, I suppose, and you can't make yourself fall out of it. I am trying to fit in down here. Trying hard. I mean, Susan Grant is trying to fit in. The streets are jammed with cars, and the sidewalks are wall-to-wall people, and pretty much no one looks at anyone else or says hello. You were right about the beauty, though. When I let myself see it, it's there. I see it in Mount Rainier, which reminds me of Iliamna and can magically appear and disappear. Down here, it's called the mountain, because really they only have the one. Not like home, where mountains form the exposed spine of our world. My grandparents care about the weirdest things, how the table is set, what time we eat, how well I tuck the sheets into the bed, how tightly I braid my hair. My grandmother handed me tweezers the other day and told me to pluck my eyebrows. But we have a nice little rental house not far from them, and we can visit if we are careful. I think Mama is surprised to find that she likes to be with her parents. We have plenty to eat and new clothes, and when we all sit around the dinner table, we try to knit our lives together, dropped stitches and all. Maybe that's what love is. Dear Matthew, Christmas here is like an Olympic event. I've never seen so much glitter and food. My grandparents gave me so many gifts, it was embarrassing. But afterward, when I was in my own room alone, staring out the windows at neighbors we stay away from, looking at houses strung in twinkling lights, I thought of real winter, of you, of us. I looked at the picture of your grandparents and reread your grandmother's newspaper article. I wonder what it's like for our baby. Does she feel how uncertain I am? Does the song of my broken heart play for her? I want her to be happy. I want her to be the child of our love, of who we were. I think I felt the baby move today. I'm thinking of her as Lily, after your grandma. A girl needs to be strong in this world. Dear Matthew, I can't believe it's 1979. I called the rehab facility again today and heard the usual. No change. Unfortunately, my mother overheard my call. She blew her stack and said I was being stupid. Apparently, the police can trace the call to my grandparents' house if they wanted to, so I can't call anymore. I can't put us all at risk, but how can I stop? It's all I have left of you. I know you're not going to get better, but every time I call, I think, maybe this time. That hope is all I have, useless or not. But that's bad news, and that's easy. You want good news. It's a new year. I am going to the University of Washington. My grandmother pulled some strings and got Susan Grant registered with no evidence of graduation from high school. Life sure is different in the outside. How much money you have matters. College isn't what I expected. Some of the girls wear these fuzzy Shetland sweaters and plaid skirts and knee socks. I guess they're sorority girls. They giggle and clump together like sheep, and the boys who follow them around are so loud a bear could hear them coming from a mile away. In class, I pretend you're beside me. Once I believed it so much, I almost wrote a note to pass you under my desk. I miss you. Every day, and even more at night. So does Lily. She started to kick me awake sometimes. When she does get all squirrely, I read her Robert Service poems and tell her about you. That quiets her right down. Dear Matthew, spring here is nothing like breakup. No earth falling away, no house-sized blocks of ice snapping free, no lost things seeping up from the mud. It's just color everywhere. I've never seen so many flowering trees. Pink blossoms float through the campus. My grandfather says the investigation is still open, but no one is looking for us anymore. They assume we're dead. In a way, it's true. The Albrights vanished into nothing. At night, I talk to you and Lily now. Does that mean I'm crazy or just lonely? I imagine all three of us huddled in bed with the northern lights putting on a show outside our window while wind taps on the glass. I tell our baby to be smart and brave, brave like her dad. I try to tell her to protect herself from the terrible choices she might someday face. I worry that we Albright women are cursed in love, and I hope she will be a boy. Then I remember you saying that you wanted to teach your son the things you had learned on the homestead, and, well, it makes me so sad I crawl into bed and pull the covers over my head and pretend I'm in Alaska in the winter. My heartbeat turns into wind pounding on the glass. A boy needs a father, and I am all Lily has. Poor girl.
Those Lamaze classes were bogus!
Lenny yelled when the next contraction twisted her insides and made her scream.
I want drugs!
You wanted natural childbirth. It's too late for drugs now, Mama said.
I'm 18 years old. Why would anyone listen to what I want? I know nothing, Lenny said.
The contraction ebbed. Pain receded. Lenny panted. Sweat itched and crawled across her forehead. Mama picked an ice chip from the plastic cup on the table by the hospital bed and popped it in Lenny's mouth.
Put morphine in it, Mama, Lenny begged. Please, I can't take this. It was a mistake. I'm not ready to be a mother.
Mama smiled.
No one is ever ready.
The pain began building again. Lenny gritted her teeth, concentrated on breathing, like that helped, and clutched her mother's hand. She squeezed her eyes shut, panting, until the pain crested. When it began, finally, to subside, she sank back into the bed, spent. She thought, Matthew should be here, but she pushed the thought aside. Another contraction hit seconds later. This time, Lenny bit her tongue so hard it bled.
Scream, Mama said.
The door opened and her doctor came in. She was a thin woman wearing blue scrubs and a surgical cap. Her eyebrows were unevenly plucked, which gave her a slightly askew look.
Ms. Grant, how are we feeling? The doctor asked.
Get it out of me, please!
The doctor nodded and put on gloves.
Let's check, shall we?
She opened the stirrups. Normally, Lenny would not be relieved when a relative stranger sat between her spread legs, but right now, she would have splayed herself at the observation deck of the Space Needle if it would end this pain. "It looks like we're having a baby," the doctor said evenly.
"No shit!"
Lenny shouted at another contraction. "Okay, Susan. Push. Hard. Harder." Lenny did. She pushed, she screamed, she sweated, she swore. And then, as quickly as her pain had come, it ended. Lenny collapsed into the bed. "A baby boy," the doctor said, turning to Mama. "Grandma Eve, do you want to cut the cord?" As if through mist, Lenny watched her mother cut the cord and follow the doctor over to an area where they wrapped the newborn in a pale blue thermal blanket. Lenny tried to sit up, but she had no strength left. "A boy, Matthew. Your son." Lenny panicked, thought, "He needs you, Matthew. I can't do this." Mama helped Lenny into a sitting position and put the tiny bundle in her arms. Her son. He was the smallest thing she'd ever seen, with a face like a peach and muddy blue eyes that opened and closed, and a little rosebud mouth that made sucking motions. A pink fist burst out of the blue blanket, and Lenny reached down for it. The baby's minuscule fingers closed around hers. A searing, cleansing, enveloping love blew her heart into a million tiny pieces and reshaped it. "Oh my God," she said in awe. "Yeah," Mama said. "You've been asking what it's like." "Matthew Denali Walker, Jr.," she said quietly. A fourth-generation Alaskan who would never know his father, never feel Matthew's strong arms around him or hear his steadying voice. "Hey, you," she said. She knew now why she had run away from their crime. She hadn't known before, hadn't understood truly what she had to lose. This child, her son. She would give up her life to protect him. She would do anything and everything to keep him safe, even if that meant listening to her mother and cutting the last tender thread to Alaska and Matthew, the calls to the rehab center. She wouldn't call again. The very thought tore her heart, but what else could she do? She was a mother now. She was crying softly. Maybe Mama heard and knew why and knew there was nothing to say. Or maybe all mothers cried right now. "Matthew," she whispered, stroking his velvet cheek. "We'll call you MJ. They called your daddy Maddie sometimes, but I never did. And he knew how to fly. He would have loved you so much."
1986. 27.
"I don't know how to live with what I've done to her life," Cora said.
"It's been years," her mother said. "Look at her. She's happy. Why must we keep having this conversation?"
Cora wanted to agree. It was what she said to herself on a daily basis. "Look, she's happy." Sometimes she was able to almost wholly believe it, and then there were days like today. She didn't know what caused the change. Weather, maybe. Old habits. The kind of corrosive fear that once it moved in, pitted your bones and stayed forever. 7 years had passed since Cora had dragged Lenny away from Alaska and brought her here, to this city poised on the water's edge. Cora saw how Lenny had tried to put down roots into this rich, wet land, tried to flourish. But Seattle was a city of hundreds of thousands. It could never speak the rugged language of Lenny's pioneer soul. Cora lit a cigarette, drew the smoke into her lungs, and let it linger there. Instantly, she was calmed by the familiar act. She exhaled and lifted her chin, trying to get comfortable on the camp chair. Her lower back ached from a night spent in the pseudo-wilderness sleeping in a tent. Her breathing was ragged from a persistent cold.
Not far away, Lenny stood at the river's edge with a little boy on one side of her and an old man on the other. She cast her line out in a graceful, practiced arc, the line snapping and dancing in the air before it cascaded into the calm water. Late spring sunlight painted all of it gold, the water, the three mismatched figures, the nearby trees. Even as the sun shone down on them, it began to rain, tiny droplets drawn from the damp air. They were in the Ho Rainforest, one of the last refuges of pure wilderness in the populated western half of Washington State. They came here as often as they could and pitched their tents on campsites that offered both electricity and water. Here, away from the crowds, they could be who they really were. They didn't have to worry about being seen together or making up stories or telling lies. It had been years since anyone had mentioned the Albright family in Alaska or gone looking for any of them, but still, they were always on guard. Lenny said she could breathe in this wilderness, where the trees were as big around as Volkswagens and grew high enough to block out the recalcitrant sun. She said she had things to teach her son that were part of his heritage, lessons that couldn't be taught where the world was paved and lit by street lamps, things his father would have taught him. In the past few years, Cora's father had become an avid fisherman, or maybe he was just an avid grandfather who did anything and everything to make Lenny and MJ smile. He'd quit practicing law and had become a putterer around the house. So they came camping out here as often as they could, regardless of the rain that greeted them 10 times out of 12, even in midsummer. They caught fish for dinner and fried it in cast iron skillets over an open flame. At night, while they all sat around the campfire, Lenny recited poems and told stories set in the wilderness of Alaska. It wasn't fun for Lenny. It was something different, vital, a way to release the pressure that built up all week as she walked among the hordes at the sprawling University of Washington campus, as she sold books to patrons at her part-time job at the giant Shorey's bookstore on First Avenue and took photography classes at night. Lenny came out here to refind herself in nature, to recover whatever small piece of her Alaskan soul she could find, to connect her son to the father he didn't know and the life that was his by birthright, but not in fact. Alaska, the last frontier, the land that would always and forever be home to Lenny, the place where she belonged. "You can hear him laughing," her mother said. Cora nodded. It was true. Even with the percussive drumbeat of the increasing rain, drops landing on nylon tents and plastic hoods and plate-sized leaves, she could hear her grandson's laughter. MJ was the happiest of kids, a boy who made friends easily and followed the rules and still held your hand when you walked down the sidewalk toward school. He cared about the usual things for a boy his age, action figures and cartoons and popsicles in the summer. He was still young enough that he didn't ask a lot of questions about his father, but that would come. They all knew it. Cora knew, too, that when MJ looked at his mother's smile, he saw none of the shadows crouched behind it. "Do you think she will forgive me someday?" she asked, staring out at Lenny. "Oh, for the love of Pete, for what? Saving her life? That girl loves you, Coraline." Cora took a long drag on her cigarette, exhaled. "I know she loves me. I have never doubted for a second that she loves me. But I let her grow up in a war zone. I let her see what no child should ever see. I let her know fear of a man who was supposed to love her, and then I killed him in front of her. And I ran and made her live life under an alias. Maybe if I'd been stronger, braver, I could have changed the law, like Yvonne Wanroe. It took years for that woman's case to get to the Supreme Court, and you were in Alaska, not Washington. Who knew the law would finally recognize a battered woman defense? And your dad still says it rarely works. You have to let all of that go. She has. Look at her down there with her son, teaching him how to fish. Your daughter is fine, Cora. Fine. She's forgiven you. You need to forgive yourself. She needs to go home. Home? To the cabin with no plumbing or electricity? To the brain-damaged boy? To
to an accessory after the fact charge? There's that new blood test now, something about DNA, so don't be ridiculous, Cora.
She reached out, slid her arm around Cora's shoulder.
Think of all that you've found here. Lenny's getting an education and becoming a wonderful photographer. You like your job at the art gallery, your home is always warm, and you have a family you can count on.
What she'd done to her daughter had been forgiven, it was true, and Lenny's forgiveness was as real and true as sunlight. But Cora, try as she had for all of these years, couldn't forgive herself. It wasn't the shooting that haunted her. Cora knew she would commit the same crime again in the same circumstances. She couldn't forgive herself for the years that came before, for what she allowed and accepted, for the definition of love she'd handed down to her daughter like a dark incantation. Because of Cora, Lenny had learned to be happy with half a life, pretending to be someone else, somewhere else. Because of Cora, Lenny could never see the man she loved or go home again. How was Cora supposed to forgive herself for that?
Smile. You're happy.
Lenny didn't know why she had to remind herself to smile and look happy on this bright day in June when they were at the park to celebrate her graduation from college. She was happy, really, especially today. She was proud of herself, the first female in her family to graduate from college. It had taken a long time. Still, she was 25 years old and a single mother with, as of tomorrow, a college degree in visual arts. She had a loving family, the best kid in the world, and a warm place to live. She was never hungry or freezing or afraid for her mother's life. Her only fears now were garden variety parenting fears, kids crossing the street alone, falling off swing sets, strangers appearing out of nowhere. She never fell asleep to the sound of screaming or crying and never woke to a floor strewn with broken glass. She was happy. It didn't matter that she sometimes had days like today, where the past poked insistently into her view. Of course she would think of Matthew today, on this day, which was one they'd talked about so often. How many times had a conversation between them begun with, "When we finish college?" Instinctively, she lifted her camera and minimized her view of the world. It was how she managed her memories, how she processed the world, in pictures. With a camera, she could crop and reframe her life. Happy. Smile. Click, 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 and she was herself again. She could see what mattered. Unbroken blue sky, not a cloud in sight, people all around. Sunshine called out to Seattleites in a language they understood, dragged them out of their hillside homes, and encouraged them to put on expensive sneakers and enjoy the mountains and lakes and winding forest roads. After which they would stop by their local Thriftway grocery store for prepackaged steaks to put on their grills at weekend barbecues. Life was soft here in Seattle, safe and contained. Crosswalks and traffic lights and helmets and policemen on horses and bicycles. As a mother, she appreciated all that protection, and she had tried to settle into this comfortable life. She never told anyone, not even Mama, how much she missed the howling of wolves, or a day spent alone on the snow machine, or the echoing crack of ice in the spring breakup. She bought her meat instead of hunting it. She turned on the faucet for water and flushed her toilet when she was finished. The salmon she grilled in the summer came already cleaned and filleted and washed, caught like strips of silver and pink silk behind cellophane canopies. Today, all around her, people were laughing, talking, dogs were barking, jumping up to catch frisbees, teenage boys threw footballs back and forth.
"Look,"
MJ said, pointing up at the pink "Congratulations, graduate" balloon bobbing at the end of a yellow streamer. He had a half-eaten cupcake in one hand and wore a goatee of frosting. Lenny knew he was growing up fast, a first grader now. So she had to snuggle and kiss him while he still allowed it. She scooped him into her arms. He gave her a sweaty, buttercream kiss and hugged her in that way of his, all in, arms thrown around her neck as if he were drowning without her. The truth was that she would drown without him.
Who is ready for dessert? Grandma Gallagher said from her place by the picnic table. She had just finished setting out Lenny's favorite dessert, Agutog, Eskimo ice cream made of snow, Crisco, blueberries, and sugar. Mama had saved clumps of winter snow in the freezer just for this. MJ sprang free, hands raised triumphantly, both hands, just to be sure he was seen.
Me! I want Agutog!
Grandma came around the picnic table and stood beside Lenny. Grandma had changed a lot in the past few years, softened, although she still dressed for the country club, even on a picnic.
I am so proud of you, Lenny, Grandma said.
I'm proud of me, too.
My friend Sandra from the club, she says there's an opening for a photographer's assistant at Sunset Magazine. Should I have her make a call on behalf of Susan Grant?
Yeah, Lenny said. I mean, yes, please. She could never quite adjust to the way things were done down here. Life seemed to reward who you knew more than what you could do. One thing she knew, though, she was loved. Grandma and Grandpa had welcomed them from the beginning. For the past few years, Lenny and Mama and MJ had lived in a small rental home in Fremont and visited her grandparents on weekends. At first, they'd been on guard constantly, afraid to make friends or talk to strangers. But in time, the Alaska police had stopped looking for them, and the threat of discovery had faded into the background of their lives. MJ made so much noise and had so much energy that the staid house on Queen Anne Hill had become a boisterous place. On their nights together, they gathered around the television to watch shows that made no sense to Lenny. She read instead. She was on her third consecutive read of Interview with the Vampire. MJ was the wheel. They were the spokes. Love for him united them. As long as MJ was happy, they were happy. And he was a very happy child. People remarked on it all the time. Lenny saw her mother, standing off by herself at the edge of the playground, smoking, a hand splayed across her lower back in a way that looked unnatural. In profile, Lenny could see how sharp her mother's cheekbones were, how colorless her lips, how thin her face was. As usual, she wore no makeup, and she was almost translucent. She had stopped dyeing her hair a year ago. Now it was a washed-out, gray-threaded blonde.
I want Agutog,
MJ yelled, tugging on Lenny's sleeve. His voice was sluggish from the stuffiness of his latest cold. Ever since he started at the private school near the house, he, and all of them, really, had battled colds. And how do we ask for that? Lenny asked.
Please?
MJ said. Okay, go get Grandma. Tell her to put out the dang cigarette and come to the table. He was off like a shot, scrawny white legs moving like egg beaters, his blonde hair streaming back from his pale, pointed face. Lenny watched him drag Mama back to the picnic table, her face flushed with laughter. Lenny glanced sideways, turning her attention away for just a moment. She saw a man standing near the entrance gate to this public park, blonde hair. It was him. He'd found her. No. Lenny sighed. She hadn't called the rehabilitation center in years. She'd picked up the phone often but never dialed. It didn't matter that the threat of discovery had lessened. It still existed. Besides, when she had called all those years ago, his condition had always been the same. No change. She knew he'd been irreparably damaged by the fall, and that the boy she loved lived only in her dreams. Sometimes, at night, he whispered to her in her sleep, not always, not even often, but enough to sustain her. In her dreams, he was the still smiling boy who'd given her a camera and taught her that not all love was scary. Come on, Grandma said, taking Lenny by the arm. This is great, Lenny said. The words felt wooden at first, perfunctory. But when MJ shot up and started clapping and yelled, Yay, Mommy! In that Mickey Mouse voice of his, she couldn't help smiling. The dark edges fell back again, receded until there was only here, only now, a sunlit day, a celebration, a family. Life was like that, full of quick silver changes,
Joy reappeared as unexpectedly as sunlight. She was happy. She was.
Tell me about Alaska, Mommy,
MJ said that night as he crawled into his bed and pulled up his comforter. Lenny brushed the fine white curls from her son's forehead, thinking, again, how much he looked like his father. Shove over, she said. Lenny climbed in beside him. He rested his head on her shoulder. The room was mostly dark, illuminated only by a small Star Wars bedside lamp. Unlike Lenny, her son was growing up as a child of commercial America. After the picnic at the park and all the fun they'd had today, she knew that MJ was exhausted, but he wouldn't sleep without a story. The Girl Who Loved Alaska. It was his favorite story. Lenny had begun it years ago and expanded it over time. She'd imagined a society living in the turquoise, glacial cold waters of an Alaskan fjord in buildings that had been downed when the mighty Mount Aku erupted. These people, the Raven Clan, wanted desperately to rise into the light again, to walk in the sunshine, but a curse made by the eldest son of the Eagle Clan had condemned them to remain in the icy water forever, until a whisperer could call them back. Katyak was the Whisperess, a foreign girl of pure heart and quiet strength. The story had unfolded week by week, with Lenny telling just enough each night to lure her son to sleep. She'd created Katyak from the native Alaskan myths she'd read as a girl, and from the harsh, beautiful land itself. Uki, the boy Katyak loved, the landwalker, had called to her from the shore. There was no doubt in Lenny's mind who the lovers were, or why the story felt so tragic to her. Katyak defied the gods and dared to swim to the shore. She shouldn't have been able to do it, but her love for Uki gave her special power. She kicked and kicked and finally broke out of the waves, felt sunlight on her face. Uki plunged into the ice-cold water, calling out her name. She saw his eyes, as green as the calm waters of the bay which had once been her people's home, his hair the color of sunlight. Kat, he said, take my hand. Lenny saw that MJ had fallen asleep. She leaned over to kiss him and eased out of bed. The small single-story house was quiet. Mama was probably in the living room, watching Dynasty. Lenny walked down the narrow hallway of their rented house, the walls on either side of her decorated with Lenny's photographs and MJ's artwork. The claustrophobia that had once assailed her in this fake wood-paneled, dimly lit hallway had disappeared long ago. She had tamed the wildness within her as determinedly as she'd once tamed the wilderness itself. She'd learned to navigate in crowds, to live with walls, to stop for traffic. She'd learned to watch for robins instead of eagles, to buy her fish at Safeway, and pay money for new clothes at Frederick and Nelson. She'd learned to blow-dry and condition her layered shoulder-length hair, and to care that her clothes matched. These days, she plucked her eyebrows and shaved her legs and armpits. Camouflage. She'd learned to fit in. She went into her room and flicked on the light. In the years they'd lived here, she'd changed nothing in this room and bought almost nothing to decorate it. She saw no point. It was bare and ordinary, filled with the garage sale furniture they'd collected over the years. The only real sign of Lenny herself was the photography equipment, lenses and cameras and bright yellow rolls of film, stacks of pictures and collections of photograph albums. A single album was filled with her pictures of Matthew and Alaska. The rest were more current. Tucked into the corner of the vanity mirror was the picture of Matthew's grandparents. This could be us. Beside it was the first picture she'd taken of him with her Polaroid. She opened the door that led out onto the small cedar-planked deck that ran the length of the house. In the backyard, Mama had cultivated a large vegetable garden. Lenny stepped out onto the deck and sat in one of the two Adirondack chairs that had been here when they moved in. Overhead, the star-spangled sky looked limitless. A solid cedar fence outlined their small lot. She could smell the distant aroma of the first summer barbecues and hear the jangle of kids' bikes being put away for the night. Dogs barked. A crow scolded something in a sharp little caw, caw, caw. She leaned back in the chair, stared up, and tried to lose herself in the vastness of the sky.
Hey, Mama said from behind her. You want some company?
Course.
Mama sat down in the second chair, positioned close enough that they could hold hands as they sat here. It had become their place over the years, a narrow deck that jutted out into some dimension that was neither past nor present. Sometimes, especially this time of year, the air smelled of roses.
I'd give anything to see the Northern Lights, Lenny said.
Yeah, me too.
Together, they stared up at the immense night sky. Neither of them spoke. They didn't need to. Lenny knew they were both thinking of the loves that had once been theirs.
But we have MJ, Mama said.
Lenny held her mother's hand. MJ, their joy, their love, their saving grace. 28. Cora had pneumonia. It was hardly a surprise. For weeks, she'd caught every illness that moved through MJ's school. Now she sat in the sterile waiting room, irritated, impatient to be let go. Waiting. She appreciated all of the just-to-be-sure tests her mother's doctor had insisted upon, done, but Cora just wanted to get an antibiotics prescription and get out of here. MJ would be home from school soon. Cora flipped through the latest People magazine. Ted Danson leers again on Cheers was the absurd headline. She tried the crossword puzzle in the back of the magazine, but she didn't know enough popular culture to make much headway. More than 30 minutes later, the blue-haired nurse returned to the waiting room and led Cora into a small office, its walls lined with degrees, awards, that sort of thing. Cora was shown to a hard black chair. She sat down, instinctively crossing her legs at the ankles as she had been taught years ago in her country club days. It occurred to her suddenly, stupidly, that it was a metaphor for all that had changed for women in her lifetime. No one cared anymore how a woman sat. So, Evelyn, the doctor said. She was a stern-looking woman with steel-wool hair and an obvious affection for mascara. She looked like she survived on black coffee and raw vegetables, but who was Cora to judge a woman for being thin? A series of x-rays hung across a light-bright-like screen behind her desk.
Where's the pneumonia? Cora asked, lifting her chin toward the images.
An octopus devouring something, that was what it looked like. The doctor started to speak, then paused.
Doctor?
Dr. Prasher pointed to one of the images.
You see these large white areas? Here, here, and here? You see this white curve? The shadow along your spine? It is all highly suggestive of lung cancer. We will need more tests to be sure, but... Wait, what? How could this be happening?
Oh, right. She was a smoker. It was lung cancer. For years, Lenny had nagged Cora about the habit, warned her of this very scenario. She had laughed and said, "Hell, baby girl, I could die crossing the street."
The CT scan shows a mass on your liver, which indicates metastasis, Dr. Prasher said, and kept talking.
The words became a tangle in Cora's mind, consonants and vowels, a series of breaths taken and released. Dr. Prasher went on, using ordinary words in an extraordinary, impossible-to-grasp context. Bronchoscopy. Tumor. Aggressive.
How long do I have?
Cora asked, realizing belatedly that she'd interrupted the doctor in the middle of something.
No one can tell you that, Miss Grant, but your cancer appears to be aggressive. Stage 4 lung cancer that has already metastasized.